Good death needs three things. It needs equipment, it needs medication, and it needs the staff to administer it. Do you have enough syringe drivers in the NHS to deliver medications to keep people comfortable when they're passing away?
Yes, right now we do.
And the second one is with that, that's to the syringe drivers deliver medication, particularly things like midazolam and morphine. Do you have any precautions put in place to make sure we have enough of those medications to be delivered?
Yes, we do.
Something was wrong when I found out last year that my dad had a DNR put in place when he was in his care home. So I spoke to a whistleblower doctor. She told me they were being put on people who were over 60. They were classed as elderly. She told me they were being put on people with mental health issues, people with physical disabilities, even on children with autism. So I wrote an article which went viral. David Icke spotted it, invited me onto his podcast to talk about what he called the premeditated murder of the elderly in care homes and hospitals across the UK. Over the next few weeks, many people approached me with heartbreaking stories of how their relatives and loved ones had been killed in hospital. There were too many not to believe, so I decided to pitch it to the national newspapers. I contacted 28 editors and got no immediate response. After chasing a few times, a couple of them got back to me. But after much discussion, and even after they talked to some of the people that I'd spoken to, they decided not to run the story. They never explained why. These stories needed to be heard, and I realised they'd be better captured on film than on paper. In August 2021, Lee's dad went into hospital with suspected pneumonia.
Can you tell me a bit about him and what he was like, not only health-wise, but personality-wise?
Oh, he was a beautiful person, an incredible soul, gave everything to everybody in his life, you know.
Musician, you said?
Yeah, yeah, great blues guitarist. Everybody knows him in Liverpool, and he was just an incredible person, you know. So sad. And so Dad was in a room on his own. He was awake at the time. But upon going in that room, he was sedated with midazolam and given morphine and never woke up.
How do you know he was given morphine and midazolam?
They told us.
Patients who are prescribed end-of-life drugs such as midazolam and morphine have it administered in one of three ways: orally, by injection, or via a syringe driver. A syringe driver is a device used to administer drugs over a prolonged period, very gradually.
T34 is a cocktail of medication drip feeding under the skin. And now I know that was given to kill her as quickly as possible.
Midazolam doses vary. Titration, during which a drug should be administered gradually at a small dose leading to a larger dose, seems to have been abandoned. Ravi and his wife Diane were NHS nurses. In February 2021, Diane was admitted to hospital after a bad reaction to the AstraZeneca vaccine. Midazolam, 2.5 milligrams, that can kill a person.
Mm.
So they always give 2.5 milligrams, and they shouldn't do that, especially with very small, light people.
Right.
They need to start with 0.5, then 1, then 1.5, then 2. And on a syringe drive, it's a constant pumping of the drug into the body.
Yeah.
And that's not a treatment, and that's not a cure. There's only one outcome when they put that into somebody's body and keep it going in.
Mm.
It kills them, and they know that.
Dr. Mukeshi has said to me, it was end of life. end of life and end of life.
And you accepted that.
And I witnessed what he said, Diane, end of life, end of life. Nothing, no matter how I shout, what I try to do, it won't be possible. It's sign end of life, and there'll be end of life.
And you felt powerless.
Powerless.
Yeah.
Exactly. Powerless. Powerless. Yes.
Mark's 60-year-old mum was taken to hospital in August 2021. She was complaining of headaches and breathing problems. A COVID test proved negative. So going back to when you called the ambulance, what happened when the ambulance arrived?
First responder turned up, so it was a paramedic in one of those, you know, the ambulance cars. Mm-hmm. He came in, started giving mum oxygen. He just turned around and said, this is COVID. And I was taken back by that, and I said, sorry, COVID? And he said, yeah. It was really weird. He was kind of boastful about it. So I just said, you haven't even tested it yet. And he said, no, he was certain. My mum said, leave the oxygen here. I'll be all right with that. He turned around and said, I can't. She said, well, I wouldn't go to hospital. He said, well, I can't leave the oxygen. He said, I have to go. If you don't want to come to hospital, I have to go. And he just said, you'll die. The ambulance turned up and they said, we're going to take you to the hospital. And mum was like, no, I don't want to go to hospital. And then the woman, paramedic, said to my mum, well, you need to go to hospital because you might have COVID. And then the first responder turned and said, no, it's COVID. It's definitely COVID. And it was a weird silence. It was like he was trying to enforce what he diagnosed as that's it, you know, job done. As they wheeled her out the her flat, I ran over and I kissed her. And the paramedic said, you can't do that. And I just turned around and I said, that's my mum. Nicola's 59-year-old dad, Martin, was admitted into hospital in May 2020 with suspected COVID.
Hi, how are you?
Lovely to meet you.
Thank you.
Wow, look at that.
So we did a memorial for him because he was cremated.
Yeah.
And we're going to scatter his ashes in places that he loved.
Yeah.
Holiday destinations, seaside, places he never got to go. But there is some ashes that we've laid there.
Oh.
That's where we
so nice.
Remember him.
It's a really nice idea.
And it's just because life takes over. You can't go to a grave every day, can you? So
no.
At least if you're at home.
That's a really good idea. I've never seen that done before in a garden, but it's a really nice idea.
It's just closeness.
Yeah. What actually led him to be in hospital in the first place?
He said he took bad in March. He said he didn't feel well. So we rang 111 and they said, oh, it sounds like he's got COVID. Isolate for 2 weeks. 2 weeks later, he was still no better. So we took him up to A&E. And they put him on the assessment unit.
Yeah.
He tested negative for COVID on entry,
yeah.
But they put him on a hot ward where he remained for 16 days.
So why did they put him in a COVID ward if he tested negative?
They won't answer me.
When a DNAR, do not attempt resuscitation order, is put in place, it means that should a person's heart or breathing stop, medics will not try to bring them back to life.
It was about 5 o'clock in the evening that the doctor rang and he says, your dad's very poorly. We don't know what to do with him. Can I ask your opinion on a DNAR? We've had an in-depth conversation with your dad. He wants a DNAR. I really wasn't expecting to have that conversation. Right. So they caught me off guard. But then he said, your dad's agreed to it. So I said, well, if that's my dad's wishes, who am I to...
And you had no reason not to believe them either.
No. But then we kept ringing my dad's phone and he wasn't answering. When we eventually got through to him, it was about 9 o'clock in the evening, and he said that they'd scared him by saying that if something happened, they wouldn't help him. So I said, but you've agreed. He said, no, I don't know what they're saying to me, Bab. That was his exact words.
Just before Christmas 2020, Michelle's mum and Barry's wife, Christine, was taken to hospital with breathing difficulties.
Dad was decorating the house and decided to do up the house and had this old floor that had been down for since I got married, and him and my older brother were pulling it up and the dust was really heavy. It was about 6 o'clock, I think, my older brother rang and said, Mum's called an ambulance. And then the next day we got a phone call from the hospital asking about Mum's last wishes. I'm like, what do you mean her last wishes? Like DNR? And I was like, I don't get what you're going on about. Or would she like to be resuscitated? I said, absolutely. My mum's always said, if I've got cancer, then it might be a different thing. But otherwise, you fight to the bitter end. Yeah. And all they kept saying all over the weekend was, she's comfortable, she's stable. That was it. We went up there, we sat in this room, and he started telling us that, you know, Mum's this, but there's not much more we can do for her, and we advise you to turn off the machine. Mm. And I was like, what? And he said...
So turn off the ventilator.
Yeah, turn the machine off, that's it, yeah, finish. And he said that we'd put something in her stomach and that, and I said, but you're, like, putting her down like a dog. I said, it's like what they do in Switzerland. Oh, no, we don't do anything like that, it's nothing. And he asked, when are you thinking of doing this then? And he didn't answer, and he was all like hands and talking. And then my brother asked, still didn't answer. And then I said, but when? And he went, tomorrow at 12 o'clock.
Stuart is a new caller from Norfolk. Welcome, Stuart.
Good afternoon, Majid.
Stuart, what's the difference? Because we here weren't sure if there is a difference between assisted dying and euthanasia.
Yes, there is.
Elaborate, please.
Okay. Euthanasia is what the doctors like to call good death, which can be a decision taken by a doctor without your consent. What currently happens over here is involuntary euthanasia. That means the patient themselves is not involved with the decision-making, or even if they resist and they're against it, the doctor will still continue to make that decision. If you want to have voluntary euthanasia, that's really the difference.
So you're saying voluntary euthanasia is assisted dying?
Yes.
And euthanasia is... Where can that happen without the patient's consent, though?
It's happening all over the country every single day of the year.
Where?
We have had Liverpool Care Pathway from 1994... to 2004 names the Liverpool Care Pathway, and I'm going to shock you because I'm going to tell you that it carries on without the acronym of LCP, and up to 457 people per day in the UK are euthanized by doctors in our hospitals, in care homes, without the consent of patients or with family members who are beneficiaries to the outcome.
Now, Stuart, I didn't want to cut you off because that's not right.
Stuart Wilkie lost both his parents in December 2019. He says they were killed in two separate care homes 6 days apart.
Your story, Stuart, starts when your dad first went into hospital.
He went into hospital with a stroke, but immediately at the hospital I noticed things that I had a little bit of background knowledge about, and they said things like, we want a DNR on him immediately, and I said no.
That's a do not resuscitate.
Do not attempt resuscitation. Yeah. One of the doctors, who was the head of the gerontology department, who said, look, he's had a big stroke here. I think we could just let him go and just, he won't be able to recognise you very shortly. And this was within like 24 hours of the stroke. There was no attempt at allowing him to rehabilitate. Mm. And they said, if you wanted us to, we could withhold fluids from him and then he would just slip away. And I fortunately had the knowledge that there was a Liverpool care pathway. I'd been told it had stopped, in 2014, but I knew it hadn't. They told me he wouldn't be able to walk, he would never be able to talk, and very, very shortly he would not be able to recognise me. I said he's got his brother in America, his son, and I know he wants to get back over there, and he's also been looking after his grandson. I knew he'd been skiing till the age of 80. He was a fit, very fit octogenarian. And this one doctor, but in charge of the whole gerontology ward, old person's ward, had basically put a fatwa on him that was to stop giving him fluids, stop giving him food. They then put him in an isolation room, which is another trend you have to be very careful of, with no heating in November, right? And we're then going into December and they're trying to make out, oh, they've got a problem with it. No, they'd had a problem with it before because I knew that room. Mm. So they were leaving him with one sheet on to freeze him, basically. Spell a little myth. Everybody said that it was abolished and finished. It hasn't stopped. Basically, it'd been exposed, the public had found out about it, and the one thing that was supposed to be corrected was the shared decision making.
Yeah.
And this is a problem because the doctors and the nurses have no concept of the word or the phrase informed consent. Mm. It's their job to inform the relatives, which they're not doing. And they don't obtain consent themselves. They have to obtain that from the patient or from the patient's relative who has power of attorney. Mm. And they're not doing that either. So what they are doing is involuntary euthanasia. That is legal, and the courts are failing to prosecute. The law's already there, the 1961 Murder Act. It starts off with the do not attempt resuscitation form. You're immediately told we would never resuscitate this person. And
because of their age, usually.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely ageism going on here. If you're ever asked to do a DNAR, my advice would be never, ever sign a DNAR, right? Because it's misused and abused.
But they can be overridden now, whether the patient or the family want one or not, it can be overridden by a consultant now.
Right, but that's also unlawful, yeah. But because of informed consent and what the ethics of the GMC say, that they have to require shared decision-making and consent. Mm. They actually dropped off the word informed consent, but that was their part anyway.
Yeah.
But no doctor can obtain consent without giving the full information first. That includes all the side effects of a treatment, or any negative aspects, the positive aspects, obviously, is to give a balanced view. But he has to make you fully aware of what's involved in taking this decision. But this is the fundamental problem. Doctors cannot give consent. They have to obtain consent from the patient or somebody with power of attorney, and that's not happening at all across the board in every hospital every day. You've got a DNAR. You then got a DOLS, a deprivation of liberty. Doctors, hospitals then think they have got total power to kill that person thereafter. And that the family member has then lost all rights to their relative. They try to make out that it's a way of a mercy killing, or what they call a good death, which is even a mistranslation from what it really is, which is an easy death. It has nothing whatsoever to do with the condition of the patient at that time. Mm. I have spoken to consultant palliative experts who said fundamentally that's wrong. You can't predict death, natural death. And euthanatos comes from a Greek word, right? Euthanatos is the Greek word, which it does not mean good death, it means easy death. Mm. And you can go back to the 2nd century in Suetonius. The first description known is of August Caesar, the emperor, dying, and Suetonius described it as he was blessed with an easy death because he died naturally at the age of 75.
And use the word euthanatos for that?
Yes. And it's been bastardised ever since and taken over by eugenicists who want to use that word as a cover-up for execution. And that could be of people with Down syndrome, with autism, or just purely age, and that's what it's become. You are branded with this, they've got the paperwork, the DNAR and the Doles assessment put on you, and the next step is the they predict your death by giving you anticipatory drugs. The key's in the name, anticipatory.
And do you know what drugs they're
delivered? The standard pack is morphine, midazolam, haloperidol and hyoscine. All right? The morphine is a heavy painkiller, it will knock you out as well. Midazolam, which is now becoming very prevalent, which is a sedative only, has no effects on pain, but is being overdosed to kill people. The haloperidol has an anti-emetic because it makes you nauseous having the other two, so there's that effect. And then they have hyoscine, which is to stop you having death rattle because of the secretions. And they give them together as a lethal injection.
In May 2020, the Pharmaceutical Journal reported that a 2-year supply of midazolam had been ordered by the UK government from a factory in France. Devon-based manufacturer Accord said that stock ordered by the Department of Health and Social Care in March 2020 had already run out and that they required a further supply. According to the article, the DHSC said the request for extra stock was part of national efforts to respond to the coronavirus outbreak. On the 11th of May 2020, Accord said that the MHRA asked them to make and sell a further 22,000 packs to the NHS. By October 2020, supplies had run out again.
Midazolam is a benzodiazepine, and it's specifically designed originally for status epilepticus. So to prevent somebody who is having while somebody is having a large epileptic seizure, it's to calm their body down and to stop all the involuntary movements.
Midazolam was a later development of the benzodiazepines. Basically, it is a potent drug with a quick onset, so it found a place for conscious sedation, which is a short intravenous injection, and it will sedate somebody very effectively for a procedure for a short period of time, and then it'll wear off quickly. So it was just what's needed. The only thing was that if you used it for that, it would have to be accompanied by a pain medication because it doesn't itself remove pain. So it would always be the benzodiazepine plus an opiate to remove the pain.
It's wrong to give the two drugs together. Fundamentally wrong. There's what's called a concomitant effect. So by putting midazolam with morphine together, you've got two respiratory depressants that together slow down your breathing. And they know what they're doing when they give that drug. There was a gentleman killed in 2014 with 10 milligrams of midazolam. And the worst thing is I've also found out NHS paperwork that shows you the protocol now during the pandemic is that they're giving breathless patients up to 30 milligrams of morphine and 60 milligrams of midazolam, which is enough to kill anybody.
I heard like the sweep and sort of what was happening with the first wave in terms of midazolam and the health and the elderly, taken out from the hospitals, put into care homes, and the drug was used.
Yeah. So when you saw midazolam, how did you...
My heart sank.
Did you see it on her chart, or how did you realise?
No, he told me.
He told you, yeah.
And he said it was. We're going to start your mum off on 2.5 and 2.5. And I said, right. And he said, and that's going to be over 24 hours.
The respiratory depressant effect starts in micrograms, at 0.15. So not even 1 milligram. Mm. A fraction of that, a seventh of that approximately, of 1 gram is enough to knock some people out. And the respiratory depressant effect
in healthy people starts at that level. So you're going to become, you're going to have less oxygen to breathe.
We found out that he was, 3 days before he died, he was on the midazolam, he was on morphine. At the time when he died, they said that they hadn't had time to medicate him, but they'd actually given him livone, promazone, morphine and midazolam.
It's actually prescribed to give this medication. And this is, first of all, it is not evidence-based medicine. It's not medicine at all, really. If you start giving things that you know cause side effects, and then they actually do cause those side effects, that is, you've gone out of medicine.
They said that they were going to give her midazolam and amoxicodone, and it was to enhance her lungs, and they were going to give it as a driver into her leg.
We were talking about mum's driver. And she said, I'm here to check on your mum. Obviously, she said her levels have dropped a bit. And we're going to increase her dose an extra 15 and 15.
Of the dimorphine and the midazolam?
Morphine and midazolam.
Yeah.
And I was like, right, so she's on 17 and a half, 17 and a half. She said, no, she'll be on 20 and 20. So straight away, I thought, well, the doctor I spoke to on the Wednesday evening, who implemented the driver, told me that she started on 2.5. So either he lied and she was straight away on 5 and 5, or within that period that he told me and the call that I received from her, there was an extra 2.5 administered on both.
And this at 20 milligrams, did you say?
On both.
20 and 20?
Yeah, so...
That is a massive dose.
Well, that's the thing. So the call ended, and I was stood there, and I was just panicking. I was panicking, and my wife was like, "What's wrong?" And I said, "That's 20 and 20." I said, "So these are dangerous levels now." And she didn't say. They were obviously just again justifying it for mum's anxiety.
And every time we touched the driver that was on the end of the bed, because it was padlocked up as well, it was in a box locked up. So why is it all locked up? And I swear to God, every time we looked at it, one of us, me, my brother, him, someone would come in and write down on their glove. And I said, why do you keep writing? Oh, we're just checking what's left in it. When they first gave it, they gave her 5 milligrams of amoxicodone and midazolam together in this driver.
5 milligrams of each?
Of each, yeah.
That's a big dose.
And by the time she died, it went up to 7.1 or something, weren't it? They upped a thing, and apparently at 5 o'clock in the morning, they gave her more.
But what happened was they hid it from us. You know, they hid what was going on, really.
Were you able to speak to any doctors?
The consultant would come in from time to time. And the nurses would just say, you know, I said, you know, what's in the driver? She said, it's morphine and midazolam. I said, right. She said, what it's for? She said, it's to help his respiratory system take the oxygen in. And I knew that midazolam inhibits that.
That's right.
But the nurses just didn't. They just didn't want to know, really. It was like as if they were going through some sort of protocol.
Yeah.
Everything was matter of fact. And even the consultant said to us, it comes from above. What we do in here is all protocol.
So my head's racing. And I was like, no, I have to say something. So I'd gone upstairs. I was in my study. And I made the call back to the ward because I had a direct number to mum's ward. And I spoke to that doctor from the symptoms team. And I just said, look, I've got to talk to you. I said, you give him 20 and 20. This is a, and I did tell her, I said, this is a respiratory suppressor. Mm-hmm. I said, I know this. Isn't this dangerous? And she turned around and she said, no, it's perfectly fine. She's being monitored. And that it won't, you know, it won't have any impact in mum's sort of, you know, lifespan or anything like that.
There's what's called a paradoxical effect. And that means the drug itself can induce the symptoms that they then use to claim that you're end of life. So what do the doctors do when they see those symptoms? They give you more of the same drug. They're actually exacerbating the condition. We go back to this iatrogenic cause, physician-caused death. I don't think many nurses know properly what a paradoxical effect is. Mm. I think a lot of doctors don't know what the paradoxical effect is. And it's a very harsh thing to get your head around, that you are trying to open your mouth to get air, but because they've given you drugs, you can't get it. And these people, these our relatives, have had to watch somebody come in and give these injections. This is torture.
Had a call about 5:30, right about 5:30. From that same doctor saying, Mum's deteriorated, I think you need to come in. So, kind of went from the Thursday morning to the Thursday afternoon, it just a total, like, 180. And I was just shocked. I was just like, you know, and then I'm thinking, hang on, if they've upped their dose at 2, and now I'm getting calls, like, 2.5 hours later saying she's now deteriorated, I was like, what's going on?
And when they said she deteriorated, this was after they'd given her the 20
milligrams
of midazolam, 20 of morphine.
Exactly.
And did you make a correlation between that?
Straight away, yeah. Straight away, I was thinking, hang on, what's going on? Because I thought I had time we'd get there and I could see what's going on.
The other thing is, if you go to the British National Formulary online, and it's quite easy to look up, you look up the page midazolam, you will see that it's contraindicated to give midazolam with opiates. And that is standard practice in these end-of-life pathways. It should not be given. It's not medicine.
Why do you think they brought it in as the new protocol for the treatment of people with COVID?
It's completely contraindicated, particularly to give it with concomitant use with these drugs. So when I found this protocol which said, and I'm used to looking through medical papers, which then said that you could give up to 30 milligrams of morphine with 60. Following the execution doses, making the comparison there, when somebody died a horrible death, but still died with 10 milligrams and another morphine drug above that, hydromorphone, which is about 5 times the level of what you normally have, that the person died, but a horrible death, but they filmed it. There was a Catholic father who witnessed it. He'd given the murderer their last rites, but then he had to witness it. And he described it as prolonged torture. The executioner, he said he would rather watch 100 hangings than go through watching a human being suffer like that. This is the drug they're using on our relatives.
There is no reason to be giving these medications. Midazolam should be banned from these pathways.
If you keep somebody fully hydrated, they will be much more able to drink normally. Once you bring somebody down, it's like they're trying to take you down the frailty scale. They're making you more and more susceptible to problems. If you're dehydrated, your voice becomes very, very dry, and your overall body health, everything's supposed to be healing, your skin condition, everything deteriorates.
She never had no fluids, you know, like the saline drip, that's like fluid, is it?
Yeah.
She never had any of that. So I said, Mum, they said we're not allowed to give you any fluid or any, not allowed to give you any drink or any food, and she's like, I said, I'll give you a sponge and I'll put that on you. So I did that, and she was like, okay. But you spoke to her, didn't you?
What happened then when you went in and spoke to her, yeah?
I spoke to her and I said, you're right, darling. She said, yeah. She said, get me out of here. So I said, what's the matter? She said, get me out, get a wheelchair and get me out of this hospital now. She said, they're trying to kill me.
So I found out from other patients that they weren't giving him food and drink. And they went to procedures that I knew were linked to the Liverpool care path. They would give him a sip of drink, nothing else. So he thinks he's had a drink, but it's insufficient. And during the day, you need, an older person actually needs more than you think. And in fact, the NICE guidelines increased that from about 1.5 litres to over 2 litres. And they were giving him about, typically they would give coffees, which are diuretics, that were not decaffeinated. So you've got a drink that is actually causing you to lose fluid from your body. And they maybe give 2 or 3 of those a day. So that's actually making it worse. And then they're saying that they've given him sufficient drink. But when I asked them, what do you think is sufficient drink? They would sort of say, well, as long as he's had a litre, that's enough. And I said, well, has he had a litre? They said, well, it's actually 600. I went, well, that's insufficient for your brain, let alone your body. And your body needs at least 1.5 litres and ideally over 2 litres. That is good health. How easy is that for a physician or a nurse to follow?
Sorry, but if the, you know, if you've got to drink 2 litres of water every day, she wasn't getting that at all. You know, it was literally maybe just some of her Lucozade, we're talking sips. So mum wasn't eating, she wasn't drinking much, and the food that she was given was terrible. It was like jack of potatoes. She didn't have the energy to cut.
Did no one come and help her? Or?
Well, all the nurses were saying, in their observations, was your mum needs to eat and drink more. And I was like, right, okay, so what's being done about that?
And they wouldn't let me go and feed him, and I believe they were trying to starve him and dehydrate him. They wouldn't let me look at fluid charts, and I was inquisitive of that, but they were deliberately trying to block me. So I would go in there regardless and take him in mineral water.
Yeah.
I would take him Fresamine drinks and I would give him extra. And I knew I was keeping him going. And they hated it. I actually had a doctor put their hand on my hand and stop me, tried to give him a drink of Fresamine. And I just said, that's assault. And I carried on. And the doctor backed off.
Because they said you can't feed your wife, I was just, as I was feeding, looking out the door, she went, what do you keep looking at? I said, make sure the nurses are not coming in. She went, oh, what are you, a bottler or something? I said, no, darling, but they said that I can't feed you. Why not? I'm starving.
I've since found out that he was starved as well. His food, daily, what did they call it on the notes? Routine diet.
Yeah.
Was discontinued.
How long before his death?
3 days.
And so no water either, probably?
No.
This goes back to the Liverpool Care Pathway, designed in 1994 by a John Ellen Shaw, and they know that this is a way of expediting death.
But if you speak to doctors and nurses, they will deny that and say, of course we don't kill people in hospital, we're there to look after them and help them heal. That's what they say.
I've come to the conclusion over this whole process that there are 5% of doctors, about 1 in 20, who are, I would say, not only intelligent, very good doctors, but they've got empathy and they will actually properly talk to the family. But unfortunately, that's only 1 in 20. I believe that about 90% of the people involved are just followers that just do what they're told and lack that empathy. I think it could be restored. I think they could be retrained. And then at the other end, I think there's an equivalent 5%, 1 in 20, have got no intention of doing this and are basically eugenicists, and they want to truncate, they want to shorten the life of the elderly and the vulnerable and disabled.
If you want to be a professional nurse, it is necessary to choose a good school of nursing, because only in a good nursing school can you get the preparation on which your future as a nurse must depend.
Do you think, say, that the nurses who are administering the drugs genuinely believe that they're helping people, or do they know they're killing them?
I think there's a mixture. Some of them are knowingly doing this. Other ones are told that it's things like mercy killing, or that you just follow orders.
They don't use that phrase anymore, do they? Mercy killing. It used to be used, though.
It has come up in conversations. The other ones, again, how can you go to work, give a drug to somebody you know kills them, and then go to work the next day and do the same thing? You've got to learn from what you've just done. You have to be responsible as an individual for what you are actually doing. If you administer a drug just because somebody's told you, wearing a white coat, we're into the Milgram. Yeah.
A decade earlier, psychologist Stanley Milgram had also looked at how we respond to authority. In order to understand how people were induced to obey unjust regimes and participate in atrocities such as the Holocaust, he set up an experiment. Volunteers were told they were taking part in scientific research to improve memory.
Would you open those and tell me which of you is which, please?
Teacher.
Separated by a screen, the teacher would ask the learner questions in a word game and administer an electric shock when the answer was incorrect. He was told to increase the voltage with each wrong answer. Two-thirds of volunteers were prepared to administer a potentially fatal electric shock when encouraged to do so by what they perceived as a legitimate authority figure. In this case, a man in a white coat.
375 volts.
I think something's happened to that phone in there. I don't get no answer. He was hollering with less voltage. Can't you check in to see if he's all right, please?
Milgram's findings horrified America. They showed that decent American citizens were as capable of committing acts against their conscience as the Germans had been under the Nazis.
One of the observations made by the families I spoke to was that the doctors and nurses they dealt with spoke or behaved in a cold, robotic or cruel manner.
But they never had their best interest at heart. They just, they're like robots. It's horrible because it's completely changed. And when you question them, they don't like it.
The doctor was really cold to her.
Right.
And she was like, if you don't do this, you're going to die.
One thing I noticed with all the doctors and all the nurses that they lacked patience. If you ask my father a question, you may have to wait 30 seconds for the answer. But I could see his brain ticking. I knew he was there. And they never, ever go back and... I mean, I knew my father by then, you know, 53 years. I knew him the best of all, but they don't give you any credibility for that. That's the same I've learned throughout this, my experience with this. They treat you pretty much as dirt, that they do not accept anything that a relative says. And yet you think that's the wealth of knowledge that they should use.
I felt they were going rogue. That's how it felt.
Really?
Yeah, because it felt like... everything that I was saying and asking and begging and really sort of trying to push this is the family's wishes of how we want treated, totally ignored. And she was messaging me saying things like, I said, how do you feel on a 1 to 10? She said, I don't know, I've got to keep my wits about me because I'm dealing with these silly people.
We did go and they wouldn't loose us in. I begged and begged and she actually said, the only way you're going is if he's a goner.
And it was the last day when the consultant came in the morning and told us that Dad's unlikely to make it. But when I asked her about the COVID x-ray, she put her head down. That was telling to me.
Did you notice a lack of eye contact? A lot of
yes.
people have said
yes.
they can't look you in the eye.
No. My girlfriend said that. She said, have you noticed in here, they won't look you in the eye? I said, I know. I said, it was a very strange environment.
And he couldn't even look at us. In the little room we were in, there weren't even chairs. We were all stood up like this. So it was like a stock room with empty machines and things in. And he went to a computer and he was like this. And he said, oh, we've been ringing this number. I said, that was my dad's number about 10 years ago. And that was 5 hours later, that was 8 o'clock. And we went, we says, can we see him? And they let us, and he was still on a COVID ward. And he'd been there for 5 hours dead.
I said, look, I'm gonna call the doctor in. And then when she passed, and then all of a sudden, as I opened the door, the nurse got, what's all these people doing? I said, excuse me, my wife just passed away. I just want to know, she said, why is all these people around the bed? There's my daughter, my son. Never mind who's around the bed. My wife just passed away. Get a doctor in here. We had this flat line. She said, okay. She walked off. I thought, afterwards, you know, when he had time to think about it, all you were concerned about is the people around the bed. Not like I've just told you my wife flatlined, you know, get a doctor in. Wasn't concerned about it because they already knew.
Arriving in the hospital, she was crying, begging for help. All medication stopped, no nutrition, nothing, no machinery attached, no food, nothing. Her mouth was open, gasping for air, oxygen, and they didn't even give her oxygen, nothing.
I turn up and I'm looking at the wall, her observations are gone. Her CPAP machine's been taken out. Her SAT monitor on her finger, gone. So I went to the nurse and I said, where's all my mum's observation sheets so I can see how she's done today? And the young nurse turned around and she said, oh no, we take those out because your mum's on palliative care now. And I was like, excuse me? She said, yeah, your mum's on palliative care. And I just, it was really sort of out-of-body experience that I felt. Before I left, I said to my sister what I was going to do, and she said, I'm going to stay here tonight with mum. And I was like, yeah, stay here tonight with mum. And I said, whatever you do, make sure they do not touch mum's driver. I said, if they say to you they're going to increase the dose, tell them outright no.
I went home, made something to eat, went back about 7:30 that night, and Dad said, her oxygen keeps dropping. Her head was down. I said, lift her up. And I'd been holding her hands, and her right hands were cold, but under her armpits were really hot. So I called the nurse in, and she said, I'll go and get someone else, and they come in. And the lady said, you do know the plan, don't you? And I said, what's the plan then? And she went, I know there's a plan, but I'm not in a position to tell you. She went, I'll go and get a doctor and run out of the room. I looked across the bed to Dad. I said, what's the plan? And then I went out after the lady, and I couldn't find her, and then I spotted her in this room. She looked so nervous. Her head was down, playing with her hands. She seen me, she come out, she spoke to the matron, they were whispering, the matron come over. She said, did you speak to the doctor today? I said, yeah, but he didn't tell me of any plan. It was the one I was arguing with earlier. She said, well, I'm sorry to tell you, but your mum's passing tonight. And I went back in the room, and I was like, apparently, Dad, mum's dying tonight. We got my brothers up there. Yeah, and it was 1 o'clock in the morning when she passed away.
5 to 7, Friday morning, I get a call from the nurse that I spoke to that night. She basically said, your mum's gone. And I asked her, how did that happen? And the nurse told me, she said, your mum pulled off her high flow nasal, and we were in with another patient, we couldn't get to her.
The doctor said that he'd been called for at 1:20, that Dad had pulled the mask off and he'd gone in 20 minutes. So they basically said that he'd caused his own death.
At that point, I thought I'd resolved it with the hospital, I'd resolved the DNAR issue. That was supposed to be known to be null and void. Mm. And I honestly thought at that point I'd got him out of the serious trouble.
Right.
But they were still doing bad things to him, so then I tried to find another place where I could get him to, and just by chance a place appeared with my mother, and we were trying to get him there before Christmas. And they were both looking forward to seeing each other. Yeah. They came in on the Monday morning, having ordered the drug during the night, which is another pattern, avoided the GP that on the Friday saw my mother and said she was fine, bright, intelligent lady.
And do you know what those drugs were?
Yes, specifically diamorphine and midazolam. And my mother never stood a chance.
What do you think happened to your mum? What do you think she died of?
I think what happened was, because they neglected her and they gave her a high dose midazolam and morphine, that because it is a respiratory suppressor, and they dehydrated her for such a long time, that those drugs compounded and they magnified in terms of, you know, potency. And because she couldn't get the oxygen, the drugs just obviously, she's just suffocated.
Because of what they'd done to him at the hospital and then at the home, and he was literally technically dead, when I went back on that day, knowing that my mother had died, they had already started doing stuff on him. So when I was looking after my dad's matters, they did my mother. When I was looking after my mother, they did my dad.
It just seems like meticulously timed, doesn't it?
Way too well timed.
Orchestrated.
Well, there's no conspiracy theory here. They were in contact with each other, I know that.
You could tell it was orchestrated. The whole thing was, they knew what they were doing, and they knew the end result. Why would you treat pneumonia with morphine and midazolam?
But on the day that my mother died, right, or was killed, they immediately afterwards took advantage of that, and whilst I was dealing with her, they ordered the drugs, end-of-life drugs, for my father. And then literally the next day, I was rung up on my way to the hospital, which happens to pretty much everybody. Your father's died. And I was at the roundabout outside the hospital. And I got in there, I'm on crutches, and As I got there, I got another phone call, and they said he's gone. And I just thought, I can't believe this. Everything I've tried to do, and they've done this, and I was 2 minutes too late.
I think if you've been told to withdraw all observations without telling the family, to me that's it feels like that's murder by stealth.
When you tell other people this, they don't believe you, though. Why do you think that is?
Because it's the NHS. They're supposed to save people.
If you make the comparison to the executions that take an hour, maybe 2 hours to die, they say this is prolonged torture. What's 29 hours of slowly taking down your breathing? And I would ask anybody that gives one of these drugs to somebody, or even thinks about giving this drug, to think how you would feel if you went down from 12 breaths a minute to 6 breaths a minute to 3 breaths a minute, and you know the person walks in with that drug and they put it into your body, is slowly killing you.
Without your consent.
Without your consent, it's involuntary euthanasia. That is illegal in this country.
He was there the night before. She was fine. She was chatting. Yeah. She called my nan up. She spoke to my nan. She spoke to her friends. Sort of.
What was the last thing she said to you? Do you remember?
Yeah, she's saying, get me out of this hospital.
They're trying to kill me.
To kill me.
If you slow somebody's breathing down, this is another myth with the doctors, or even the pathologists, they'll say, oh, but there's fluid on the lung. Well, if you can't breathe, you can't respire, you can't get rid of the fluid. Mm. A lot of what we breathe out includes water. If you slow the breathing down, you build up fluid on the lungs. That's not the
and
same as
drown.
Pneumonia. Yes, and you've just said it, and it fits in with the air hunger. So it's like a fish out of water, and that's a horrible way to... The idea that this is a good death is a myth that needs to be dispelled. Mm. It's not a good death to be given these drugs. I believe that midazolam should be banned for use in the elderly, period.
Diane's gone. That's how they treat an ex-nurse. It's bad, bad, bad.
What was put on her death certificate?
So I had a call a few days after Mum's passing, basically saying the death certificate is going to be issued, and on that will be COVID-19 and pneumonitis. I immediately pushed back on that, and I explained, and I said, hang on a minute. I said, have you come to that conclusion? And she said, based off all the doctor's notes, and obviously that's what the examiner's reviewed, and he agreed. And I said, yeah, but what about what I said? And they said, we haven't got anything you've said.
What does it say on his death certificate that he died of?
COVID-19 pneumonia.
And what do you think he died of?
Demodizola.
He was killed?
Yeah.
What do you think happened to your dad? What, do you think he was deliberately killed?
I think he was, yeah. I really do.
Why would they do that?
To get the numbers up. I'm pretty sure the hospital get paid.
Is he put down as a COVID death?
COVID pneumonia. And what I have noticed, and I'll show you, is the word COVID is in capitals and the word pneumonia is in lowercase. And if anyone understands letters and language and numerology, you'll understand what that means.
What does it mean?
It means that pneumonia is the secondary and COVID is the main cause of death.
So he's down as a COVID death, so it has pushed the numbers up?
Yeah.
The mainstream media is not addressing this issue and they need to.
Why do you think that is?
I think because it's part of the narrative, and I think it conceals so many things that are happening. People who have actually died not of COVID, but of being put on the end of care pathway, and they are put into hospitals on red COVID wards. They show any sign of breathlessness, they're given this drug, and then the relatives are told they've died of COVID. And they are being cremated with no autopsies being done to show the true cause of death.
When I finally spoke to the coroner, because he passed in hospital, things take longer, don't they, than passing at home, because Mum passed at home years ago. And the coroner, at first, I said to the coroner's PA, I'm not happy with what's on the death certificate. She said, OK, you'll have to speak to the coroner, Dr. Woods. I said, that's fine. He phoned me up. He said, what aren't you happy with? I said, the fact that it's got COVID on his death certificate, and the consultant couldn't prove that he had COVID except for the PCR test. They couldn't show me an x-ray of it. And he also said, I can't take it off the death certificate and I can't have this conversation with you.
And I think there's going to be a huge problem in the country post-COVID as well because of these unnatural deaths, but particularly with this abuse of these drugs. This is induced iatrogenic cause death, and the coroners have either got to do their job properly or step aside. There's 93 of them, I don't know a good one yet. And they need to say this is wrong. The doctors, the good doctors, need to say this is wrong. I don't like the term whistleblowers, but we need honest, decent doctors to come out and stand and say this is wrong. You mustn't give these drugs together, they're harmful. That's against the Hippocratic Oath. It's actually against the oath that the nurses used to give, the Nightingale Oath. Do not give a harmful drug, right? And the doctor's the same. I will not give a harmful drug. And that is being abused, and they're in breach of their oaths, but they're also breaking the law.
The fact that the medical examiner and the coroner won't look at any of my evidence and they ignore the fact that the nurses said, you know, we basically let her suffocate. How is that not murder?
It's all come down with money, and it's just money, just to save money. You know, they don't want to keep people in hospital. They don't want to keep people in hospital, in and out of hospital. No. You know, they just want, if the patient has some kind of problem, and has reached the age of high age, you know. They think better get rid of the patient.
The one question they always ask is, why would the hospitals be doing this? Why would doctors and nurses be killing people?
At the end of the day, elderly people cost money, and they have worked out how long it takes to kill them to save money in beds. It takes 29 hours slowly to kill somebody
using
in a hospital.
Using
the midazolam combined with morphine.
Why do you think this is happening to so many people?
It just seems like money. That's all I can put it down to. It's just the cost to keep someone in hospital for any duration obviously cost the NHS X amount of money.
Was your mum getting a pension? No, you don't get pension until 65, do you?
Yeah, she wasn't entitled to a pension. Not yet. So that's a saving. The fact that she's not occupying a bed now and oxygen, that's a saving.
They saw him as a financial drain, and I think he was just another number to them. Mm. Just one that they could save funds on.
It's all about money, and to them, mum's lungs were damaged, and what's the point of keeping her going, because it costs the NHS money to keep my mum going. You know, so why would you give someone midazolam if your lungs are damaged? That doesn't help someone's lungs.
She could have been 30 years on a pension.
Yeah.
From, you know.
And she'd be here as well. Because, you know, we were going to have her move up here, possibly, and, you know, just give her a better life. Because I thought everything which went on, I spoke to my wife about it, and she supported me straight away. She just said, yeah, let's get your mum here, give her the care that she really wants and needs and deserves, and live a better life.
The end of life is really the most crucial time in your life. And you could see changes in people when they realize that they're at a point where they might be dying, and sometimes the person themselves gets an insight to this. It triggers them to start looking back over their lives, what they've done well, what they haven't done well. And many people at that point ask to see a priest. And they want to confess and get rid of what's weighing on their consciences. But to do that, you have to think very clearly. You have to be able to look back on your life and see what you've done and what you haven't done. You have to be able to mentally be able to forgive people that maybe you haven't forgiven before. And then this all culminates in the last few days. And then you can die peacefully and knowing that you've set everything right. Quite different from that is somebody who's put on a cocktail of medications.
There was not a life in her. No. Normally she'd sit there and her arms would flop or she'd move red and I'm like, you're off your face, Mum, and she just nod, yeah. This day, nothing.
I noticed her mouth was all dry, so I used to get the little sponge to stick, put it in water. And if I see the wife chewing, like biting on it, I know she was okay, she's with me, you know, like, nothing. And so I'm wetting her lips with this sponge, and I thought, well, I don't want to give her too much, go down, I'll start choking. There was no life.
I think that is one of the worst things about this medication. It is given at a time that it is most crucial spiritually in our existence. It's just the modern world which minimizes death, but death is really where we're all going, and it's the culmination of life. Now some people want to sort of draw a screen over it and say, let's not worry what's the other side of that. But if you have faith, you know what's on the other side and you know you've got to prepare for it.
Stories of people who aren't spiritual or religious in any way, but when it comes to that point, they suddenly want to talk to a priest or find themselves talking about God or heaven or the next life, even though they weren't that way inclined in previous years.
Yes.
Right at the last minute, they have some kind of revelation maybe or epiphany where they suddenly see the light.
No, that's right. It's end of life is a trigger. And Madaslam weaponizes this end of life so-called care and turns it into something that's alien to medicine, it's alien to spirituality, and it's alien to family links too. Madaslam really needs to be taken right out of the equation in care of elderly people.
To follow your parents 8 feet behind, going into the church, the two coffins together. And I just thought, it was so unnecessary. This wasn't natural, and I'm thinking of that at that moment. And I knew I had to speak first, and I had to galvanise myself. And I thought of the poem, If you can hold your head up, you know, when all about are losing theirs. And I just had to hold it together, and then I had to speak. And I knew if I lost it, my brother would lose it. And I turned round to the people there, and I just knew then that was... I had to really act, and I had to work through it. And I was crying inside. It's the needlessness about it. It's the avoidable deaths. They're not natural deaths.
It's not a normal passing. You know, I can't accept it.
They shouldn't play God. They'd have no right to decide whether someone should live or die. You know, if you die, you die. You don't die because someone's helped you along. You know, isn't that murder?